It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After high-profile hacks in the private sector and an embarrassing theft of information from government personnel files, President Obama has set up a commission on enhancing national cybersecurity. The commission is due to make its long-term recommendations by early December on tightening cybersecurity in the private sector and in the government. It's part of Obama's $19 billion proposal to boost defenses against hackers. Here in Iowa, last December, Governor Branstad issued an executive order charging Iowa government with coming up with a system to help Iowa companies prepare for cyber attacks and to lay out some of the contingencies that the state will take in the event of a significant event. Well, this week, a national cybersecurity expert is in Iowa to address the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Adam Bobro is president and CEO of Foresight Resilience Strategies in Washington, D.C. He's also a senior fellow at the George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. He served the Obama administration in a variety of positions for over 5 years, and most recently, the international lead for the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. He joins us now for this first half hour. Welcome to you, Adam.
Ben, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Want to reach out to our listeners. Any questions you have about cybersecurity, cyber theft this half hour, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org, or email. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook to leave your comment or question, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Tomorrow, Wednesday, at the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council at noon, Adam, you'll be giving a talk titled U.S.-China Cyber Agreement. Is it enough of a good thing? Give us an idea of what you'll be talking about.
Sounds good. Well, you know, last September, when President Xi visited President Obama at the White House for a state visit, the two issued a joint statement, which included a number of points of agreement, among them on cybersecurity, the endorsement of a norm against what I've termed cyber theft, largely meaning the idea that a state-supported cyber intrusions focused on stealing intellectual property, stealing business confidential information, is inappropriate. So they agreed that cyber theft was an inappropriate activity for a government to support. This obviously has been a very big area of contention between the United States and China in cyberspace, which exists. The relationship exists over a variety of domains, but this has been a particular sticking point. The idea that there are a number of private assessments and government assertions that the Chinese government sponsors the theft of intellectual property and confidential information from U.S. businesses for competitive advantages of Chinese businesses. And this was a major step forward to have this agreement in principle that we that both countries agreed that the this conduct was inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. And did that result in any change of behavior on the part of the Chinese?
I think it may be a little early to say. It's difficult to definitively say, because of course the Chinese government has always maintained, at least, that it does not engage in this activity in the first place, and that the accusations that it does so are irresponsible. So we have to look at on the U.S. side, mostly cybersecurity companies that focus on figuring out where their clients are being attacked from and how to mitigate those attacks. Mm-hmm. And then looking at that full data set, they're able to sort of attribute attacks. And so we have things like Mandiant is a company that came out with a report in 2013 that asserted that a particular unit of the People's Liberation Army in China was responsible for a lot of these attacks. And what we're hearing from those people is that the attacks have really not lessened very much. There's been maybe some change in character from a more military-led intrusion program up from the Chinese side to a more civilian-led program, but that it's still a Chinese government-sponsored and supported activity.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an idea? Does anybody have an idea of how much economic damage this is doing, to quantify in numbers?
Well, I think the most public statement of that was commissioned in a report called the IP Commission on Intellectual Property Theft in the United States, It was co-chaired by John Huntsman, the former U.S. ambassador to China, President Obama's first ambassador to China, and then presidential candidate in 2012. And Dennis Blair, who was also President Obama's first director of national intelligence, and before that had a long and distinguished career, ending as an admiral in charge of the Pacific Command. And the two of them chaired a commission that estimated, well, I guess I would say they chose from among the estimates, and they said probably $300 billion worth of wealth transfer per year, which is, as they said, similar to the amount of exports from the U.S. to Asia in 2013 or in 2012, which were the most recent year that they had figures for in 2013 when they issued the report.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say I would add a caveat to that because it's tough to value it in a direct manner. Because what you see is you see this research and development data that's taken. You see commercialization information that's taken. You see this tremendous amount of information that's taken. And then it does go a bit into a black box. We don't have a really terrific example of a product that was on the drawing board at a U.S. company, taken away by a Chinese hacker, government-sponsored or government-employed, given to a specific Chinese company, turned into a product, and then re-imported to the United States. That type of a round trip, we don't have a solid example of that. Mm-hmm. We do have examples of that in more traditional trade secret theft scenarios where you can find the insider who was hired away by the competitive company, and then you see the product of the victim of the theft loses market share vis-a-vis its competitor's product. But you don't see that in this U.S.-China sort of government-sponsored cyber theft situation.
Doesn't it work, though, both ways? Isn't the U.S. at work in trying to get an economic advantage in terms of getting intellectual property from China, originating in China, data from China? Isn't it sort of all's fair in love and economic war?
Well, the U.S. has consistently maintained that we don't engage in this type of economic espionage, that the U.S. government's cyber intelligence officers who are engaged in, legitimate intelligence activity, trying to penetrate networks in China and other countries and trying to collect information, do not actually go after the information in Chinese companies. They don't go after industrial information or information about products that may be on the drawing board or that may be in the process of development within the Chinese economy.
Is that claim to be trusted?
I believe it is. I mean, I think that there's a pretty strong, there are two pretty strong principles, I think, that drive the U.S. government in this regard. One is the idea that the U.S. government doesn't pick winners and losers. So, and this extends through our commercial diplomacy, for example. So when a company wants to bid on a competitive project in a foreign country, they have to go through a pretty rigorous process to get support from the U.S. government for that. Because generally speaking, the U.S. government says, well, we can't support you because if another U.S. company wants to bid on that project, well, we don't pick between two U.S. companies. So there would be no good mechanism, given that principle, for the U.S. government to transfer that type of intellectual property to U.S. businesses. Mm-hmm. So there's that principle. And then I think there's maybe even a deeper principle that we really believe in the United States that we have sort of a secret sauce for innovation, that our intellectual property system and that our system of financing research and development, which is significantly government funded, has generated this very virtuous cycle of increased productivity and better products and services for U.S. people. You know, stories about the internet, stories about graphene, stories about the iPhone, proliferated. And we talk about the foundational research that went into creating those things. But there's a feeling that innovation and the reward cycle that allows companies to thrive based on an idea that comes out of a laboratory, is developed into a commercialized product, and then the revenues from that commercialized product are used to fuel continued R&D by these companies in this sector. And in many sectors, actually, that virtuous cycle is something that we do probably in the U.S. almost better than anyone in the world, and that we partially understand, but don't entirely understand. And we really don't want to upset it. And so to start, and I think the mirror image is why it's such a visceral issue for U.S. officials who are bringing it up with the Chinese, because we really, there's a feeling that the what China is doing by taking this intellectual property, by trying to shortcut past the R&D and development and commercialization phase, is fundamentally going to impoverish both sides. That if you can't, if the companies that are developing this stuff in the United States can't make money off of it because it's been taken from them by their competitors, then they won't be able to invest in the next round of R&D. And then when the Chinese, if the cycle continued, that the what would be there to be stolen would actually be, in fact, poorer than it is now. So fundamentally, I do think that that's a legitimate claim, that it really is an ideological belief by the U.S. side that this is really a potentially extremely damaging activity.
If you just joined us, my guest is Adam Babrow, President and CEO of Foresight Resilience Strategies in Washington, D.C. He's a cybersecurity expert. In fact, he's a senior fellow at the George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. He's served the Obama administration in the past in a variety of positions over 5 years. And we're talking about cyber threats this half hour. Adam, as I mentioned at the outset, Governor Branstad, Iowa's governor, issued an executive order in this December charging that the Iowa government should come up with a system to help Iowa companies prepare for cyber attacks and lay out some contingencies that the state should take in the event of a significant incident. I'm wondering, what comes to mind when you are asked that question? What contingencies should our state's companies consider?
Well, I think, you know, in a very significant way, that executive order is a reflection of work done within the critical infrastructure space and within the U.S. government, of which was sort of encapsulated in the National Institute of Standards and Technology's framework for cybersecurity framework for critical infrastructure. And that document, which was issued in 2013, actually we think of it as a NIST document. We think of it as something that NIST put together, but in fact, it was an open process where players in the industry and people within other government agencies all came together and did 6 workshops to generate this. And that the tiers of preparation that are in the framework are the ones that are adopted in Senator Branstad's executive order.
Governor Branstad's, yep. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Governor Branstad's, excuse me. But what I was going to... But the interesting thing about it is it really foresees that we would change from an approach where we're looking at cybersecurity as incident response. You have a hack. Well, thinking before then, you know, the IT department is responsible for password policies and, you know, buying IT assets, computers, routers, network equipment, et cetera. Resolving your internal problems like lost passwords and things like that, and then responding when the network is attacked. So thinking about it much more in a 360-degree enterprise risk management approach to the enterprise itself, so that you see the introduction of chief information security officers or CISOs into the C-suite at companies, where you now have someone who's charged with thinking about the information security of the company at the highest levels and is responsible for more than just a budget for buying desktops or laptops or even iPads and iPhones, but is actually responsible for thinking about the product or service that the company is offering. Mm-hmm. And how could it be vulnerable? How do we reduce vulnerabilities when we're designing it or when we're rolling it out to the market? How do we think about the training that needs to happen for all of our personnel, not just the people in the IT department? And even like the legal or compliance departments, how are they dealing with potential liability against people who might not be counterparties, right? Because if your product goes out into the market and ends up, because of a cyber vulnerability, injuring someone, do you wind up with liability against someone who's not a counterparty, who isn't a customer, wasn't a supplier of yours, and now you have to deal with that liability? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. There are a lot of different ways that this is really, interestingly, a management organizational challenge, I think more than it's a technology challenge, right?
Right.
Technology challenge, of course, exists, and you can't do this without the technically trained and expert people. But you also need a general switch in the way people think about it at the executive level, at the employee level, et cetera. So it's a really good first step, I think.
Do you think, let me say this, business leaders, undoubtedly, some of them are listening to this conversation. If you're a business in Iowa or the Midwest, what type of company should be most worried about cybersecurity? Or is it across the board all? Or is there a prioritization of most threatened types of companies?
The focus thus far has really been in critical infrastructure sectors, right? But this is a pretty broad group of companies because in a lot of ways, there are so many different critical infrastructure, so many things about our economy that are interlinked. So that things you might not think of as critical infrastructure, obviously the power grid and transportation networks, but also the financial system, healthcare system. All of these are critical to our economy's continued well-being. So critical infrastructure companies, I think, are the first line of defense. I think that companies that already face a legal obligation to protect personally identifiable information above and beyond the any contractual or privacy policies that you might have in place. But so in the healthcare industry, HIPAA information, people's personal healthcare information. And the financial industry has regulations on how it treats personally identifiable information. So those sectors that have additional requirements in terms of protecting information, and because of that, I think they need to be especially careful when looking at the possibilities or the consequences of being hacked.
Adam Brombo, we have just about 5 minutes left of our conversation. I wanted to get brief answers to a few questions here, away from the main topic here. Let's talk about Hillary Clinton's email controversy. From your perspective as a cybersecurity expert, what is your take on the email controversy and the investigation? Any questions in your mind about the case that haven't been answered that may be of concern?
Well, I think we do need to know whether or not, obviously there have been allegations recently that the Ukrainian hacker had hacked into the system. The State Department has said that's not the case. It would be useful to have better information. I don't know, the public needs to know this, but certainly the folks who do cybersecurity in the government need to be aware of the actual history of what happened on that server. I think in terms of the legal question, it doesn't strike me as a very compelling argument against Secretary Clinton, because there's no indication that she knowingly tried to share any information that she shouldn't have. And that's really the legal standard. And I think that she is in a position where it may have been more expedient to do it this way, which was maybe not the best way to do it, to set up your own server. But it doesn't strike me as something that was really as problematic as I think some of her opponents are arguing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to the individual level. How concerned should we as individuals be about the theft of our personal data?
I think we should be very concerned about it. It's very, we now are sharing more and more information about ourselves on a constant basis, to the extent that our location information is shared through our cell phones. We talk a lot, I think we talk a lot in the media about the government having a lot of information on us, but actually companies have a tremendous amount of information on us that they collect, and that we essentially acquiesce to their collection of that information.
Right. We click that away when we don't read the small print, and there's four pages of something
right.
You don't want to read, but you're acquiescing there, right?
Right. And realistically, I think you're going to click those links. I mean, it otherwise becomes either, your entire life becomes reading the small print, or you are giving up services that you really want to have access to.
Mm-hmm. So what precautions would you recommend? We only have a couple minutes left. I just wanted to get maybe a few tips so people can note them.
Well, certainly I think we want to have, we want to have the best cybersecurity hygiene for everyone that we possibly can. So, using all the things that you hear all the time. So using different passwords for different things. And there are actually technology solutions, I think, that make that easier. Things like password keeping software, password generating software that can keep things in an encrypted way. Being very, very careful about clicking on the attachments and emails that you might receive that will provide access to your system, making sure that your virus protection is kept up to date. Those sorts of things are at the fundamental basic level. And then I think beyond that, just being aware of the dangers and trying to, as much as possible, stay away from, think before you click, I guess is the best recommendation.
Be cautious. Think before you click. Perhaps do read that fine print sometimes.
Exactly.
Anyway, let's talk for a minute about the future. What future trends do you see? How is this landscape, cybersecurity, cyber threats, cyber theft, changing? How will it be different, do you expect, in 5 years?
I think it's changing. It changes very rapidly, and we see new actors on the horizon all the time. I do think that in some ways the question of how do we keep ourselves safe, that what we discussed about the executive order and the NIST framework is a really important step. Because regardless of who the actors are who are trying to get our information or trying to break into our systems, a lot of those practices are going to remain the same. And building a system that's resilient, thinking about the cyber consequences of your product and service as a business, thinking about where your information is going and who's holding onto it as an individual. Those are the key things that you have to do in order to make sure that you're as covered as you can be.
Mm-hmm. And quickly, before we have to go back to the companies and the government, are we lagging behind? Are we up to the task of the security threats we're facing right now, or do we have some catch up to play?
Well, I think we'll always have catch up to play. I mean, I think the problem is we're never going to see a perfect solution to this problem. We're never going to see that cyber threats are going to go away, or that we're going to have perfectly secure systems. So we will, in a sense, we'll always be playing a little bit of catch up. I do think that there are a lot of people thinking about this. You mentioned the President's Commission on Enhancing Cybersecurity. I think that the recommendations of that commission will be very welcome, and it will be interesting to see, given that they'll say, you know, implementation of their recommendations will be something for the next president in the next administration, to see how those recommendations fare in that administration.
Okay, we have to go. Fascinating, fascinating conversation with you. Thank you for the insights, Adam Bobrow, President and CEO of Foresight Resilience Strategies in Washington, D.C., a senior fellow at George Washington University's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, speaking tomorrow at the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Thank you very much, Adam, for your expertise.
Ben, thanks for having me on.
Coming up in just a moment, a conversation with Jose Orduña. He's got a memoir out, The Weight of Shadows. He immigrated to the United States when he was just a year and a half old, took his citizenship vow just a few years ago. We'll hear from him in just a moment.